It's chapter 2. And I know we've taken a little bit longer with this chapter, but it is a kind of a serious and important pivotal chapter in the story of the Christian faith, let alone the book of Acts. So we're going to complete that this morning. And is that going to work? No. Jake, do you mind putting it to the next slide for us, mate? Cool. So as we often talk about here at Chapel Hill, the core values that we feel God has inspired us to seek and to embody all come into this main one of being an intentional community. And as I read the text, you'll see why that makes a lot of sense, that this particular talk would be about that value. Ah, look, it works. All right, so this is what it says in the end of chapter 2. Just as a quick recap, I'm sure most of you know the story, but the beginning of chapter 2, the Holy Spirit comes in a rather spectacular way. The 120 who were at that point still and pretty much the only known believers of Jesus Christ are gathered in this upper room as they were told to. And the Spirit comes and comes appearing to them as if tongues of flame on their heads and as a mighty wind, and they begin to speak in languages that they didn't know they had because they didn't have before then. And it gathers all of these people. A major crowd comes to wonder and discover what is going on. And Peter stands up and gives this great speech saying, well, this is the signs of the end of the age. The end of the age has come in this man, Jesus Christ. And unfortunately, I hate to tell you, but you killed him. That's a really bad thing to do. The one you were waiting for, you nailed to the cross, this wicked generation. But God knew that it was going to happen. It was all part of the plan. And he raised him to life, and he has come to give forgiveness, to bring you home. All you who are broken, all you who are sinners, come kneel, and he will forgive you. And you can start afresh. And the story that Peter tells is, can you see just how wicked this generation really is if it can kill even the Messiah? If that's how bad this generation is, wouldn't it be better to get out of that generation and into a new one? And that is what God is doing in Jesus Christ and this new community of believers. He is starting humanity afresh. A whole new generation nestled in the midst of the existing and dying and wicked one. And that's us, hopefully, as you see it. And at the end, when 3,000 were added to their number that day, here's what Luke writes. And they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and the fellowship, to the breaking of bread and the prayers. And awe came upon every soul, and many wonders and signs were being done through the apostles. And all who believed were together and had all things in common. And they were selling their possessions and belongings and distributing the proceeds to all as any had need. And day by day, attending the temple together and breaking bread in their homes, they received their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord added to their number day by day those who were being saved. That is the outcome. That is what God has always intended. That was the purpose and the point of all of God's work, to heal and restore and create something beautiful. I don't know if as you listened to what Steve was sharing this morning, you were struck by just how bloody and conflict-ridden our story really is. That there are people opposed to God, and a God who finds himself opposed to the people he created and loved. And blood ends up being shed somewhere, to the point that, as Peter said, Christ was given to you knowing that you would kill him, because for something new to start, for new life to begin, someone is going to have to die. And if in the story of the Israelites it was Pharaoh, his armies, the firstborn, having to die so that Israel could be free and become a nation, that wasn't going to work, and it doesn't work. So instead, God takes it upon himself in the person of Jesus Christ, ending the conflict in his own body, ending the bloodshed by shedding his own, and saying, let there be no more let there be no more. And in the light of that incredible story and that incredible news, knowing that they were talking to people who had spent years with Jesus, had seen how Jesus lived, trusted him even to the end, and realizing that this Jesus was the one that God had sent and had intended to send all along, and realizing just how wicked and culpable we are if left to our own devices, and how God had made a way to wipe all of that away, to start afresh. They start afresh. And I don't know what you see in the story, but that's what I see. I see a group of people convicted about where things were at, suddenly realizing we've got to start again. And so why do they devote themselves to the apostles' teaching? Because these guys knew what Jesus was like. First-hand accounts of how Jesus lived, what his heart was like. These 12 who were close to Jesus, who were taught by Jesus. And if you thought, my goodness, all of my life has led us as a wicked generation to this outcome, how do I be different? Well, I'm going to need to get close to people who know how to be different. So they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching because they needed to know, they needed to be retrained. And they devoted themselves to fellowship, to peacemaking, breaking bread together, which is an ancient symbol of making peace. And of coming together going, we need to learn how to live at peace. Because the generation we've been part of is about conflict and war and strife. And I don't think much has changed in that sense. I heard a story the other day, which I thought was really apropos. And it's very simple. Two women are waiting at the bus stop. And it begins to rain. It begins to team down. And one of them is really angry. And the other one is really pleased. Same event. Same thing going on. One, though, is angry about it, and the other one is pleased. Why do you think? Well, because one is a golfer and one is a gardener. And how we respond to an event has everything to do with what we are trying to do in life, with our intentions, with our desires, with what we want. Not everyone in Jerusalem who heard that story from Peter and saw Jesus, not everyone decided that that was the chance for them to start afresh. Not everyone had the attitude of a gardener. They saw what had happened and they were still hard-hearted. They wanted to be golfers. They wanted, in a sense, to have things their way. And they were not pleased and continue not to be pleased. But I wonder if we as believers have an attitude of a gardener when we think about the new life and the new generation that Christ is calling us into. So I want to talk just briefly about what we're doing in a few weeks' time. Sorry, do you mind again for me, Jake? The next slide. Thanks, buddy. We've been talking about a life group reset. So we have some life groups in the church. Maybe a couple of years back, some began to fall apart a little bit or drift a little, or they didn't quite have, sort of lost a little bit of impetus. And we've decided as elders thinking about wanting to build intentional community, life groups are a good way of going about it. They're not a silver bullet. They don't fix problems. They're a way of going about it that I think is familiar to this congregation and to many of us. So it's a good place to start. And that said, though, there is also an awareness that we need to start as we mean to go on. We need to start this reset, not by just going, let's just do what you think you should always be doing, repeat what you've done in the past. Let's start afresh and remind ourselves what we're doing when we do this. And we've asked my father, Peter Renner, to the first Sunday night. So there's a couple of Sunday nights that we're 4:30 to 7. And the reason for that timing is, A, it's in the holidays, so that we do have families who have put their hand up to say, I'd like to be involved in life groups. And in the holidays means that if on the Monday morning the kids are a little bit disrupted because the Sunday night event happened, then it's the holidays and it's not going to be too bad. And starting at that time frame, because we're going to get you in, we're going to have the conversation, Dad's going to share a few things from his experience with intentional communities in lots of different areas. And someone else is going to be caring for your children in that time frame, so you are able to just sit and engage and talk and stuff. And then we'll have a shared meal together before we depart. So that's the intent, that's the idea. And the second week particularly has a bit more of a, well, you've had something shared, you've spent some time reflecting, have a bit of a discussion, feedback to Dad, Q&A, that kind of thing. You know, well, what you said that, and what about this? And it's just kind of, I guess, iron out any wrinkles as you see them, and then form a few groups. And then term two, and I think of school terms still for some reason, in term two, those groups that form in that time will spend that term meeting and being the life group that they intended to be. And then at the end of that term, we'll get you back together again for a bit of a how did it go? What have you discovered? What's going well? What would you like to improve, etc., right? And even, actually, I've decided I don't want to be part of a group. This intentional community thing's a load of rubbish. And you are free to do that. There is no one here wanting to rule and own your life. So that's the idea. But just as we can go to the same event, or standing in the rain, one will be pleased and one will be unhappy, we can do the same thing with community. We can enter a community and then it starts to rain. And by that I mean things don't go the way you might have liked them to go. The person that you initially had a connection with turns out to be not quite as perfect as you hoped. The honeymoon is over, we call it. It's similar with churches, isn't it? You come into a church and it's really nice initially, because everyone's nice initially. Everyone's nice for an hour. And the way we run church, you don't even have to be nice that long. You know, it's just the short moment you can have tea and coffee after this thing. You just have to sit there and be kind of good people. So it's really easy. But if you get into a life group and you're starting to rub shoulders with someone a little more and start to hear what they really think about certain issues, and you realize, this person's crazy. That's when it's starting to rain. You know, the sun has gone. What do you do? Well, it depends. Are you a golfer or are you a gardener? Are you into community because you really just wanted to find some mates to go swing a ball at? Or are you in community because you, like Christ, are a gardener? You are there to till the soil, work the soil. You are there to plant and to grow. And you know that in order to do that, you're going to have to work hard. I could ask Craig Graham a lot about this. He knows what it's like to be a farmer. I could ask Bruce about this. These guys know what it's like to grow things, and it takes a lot of work. And it takes slogging through mud in winter, when the mud is not just muddy, it's cold and muddy. That is what a community is like. And I know that I'm preaching to the converted. You know what community is like. It's hard. Which is why most of our communities are surface level. Why the picture that in Acts 2, so beautiful. Because when you suddenly come out of a space of going, my goodness, I've just been saved from a train wreck. There's a genuine kind of honeymoon. Get to Acts 6 and the wheels are coming off the rails, by the way. Things are starting to fall apart a little bit for the community and they have to do some work. Community, no matter how good it looks initially, always comes to troubles and hard times. It's going to rain. And if we go into life groups going, this is the panacea, it's going to be the place I find my deep, dearest friend. No, probably not. If you do, wonderful. But that's not what these communities are for, and I don't think that's really what Christian community is about. When we sent around the clipboards asking, who would be interested in a life group, and what kind of group would you like to be into, and then of course the kind of admin part, what sort of time frame would fit. I got, I think, you know, good responses and the kind of responses that I would have given had the clipboard come to me and I would have filled it out. I wonder if I had framed it as a Christian, what kind of group do you need? whether the answers would have been slightly different. Not saying that your intentions are wrong in the answers that you gave, but if I frame the question differently, would you have responded differently? Would you have thought about it initially, as a Christian, what kind of community do I need? What am I looking for to be the Christian I'm seeking to be? So I'm asking then, you know, are you aware of yourself as a golfer at the time or as a gardener? Because when it rains, it's going to matter how you went into it and what your intentions are. We likely should be seeking the same thing in a life group that we're seeking in church. And we should be seeking in church the same thing we should be seeking in life. Because church is about the ultimate things. And if our lives are not about the ultimate things, ultimately, then they are about the passing and temporary things, and ultimately that is futility. I'm reading this because I thought this was fun. To put it another way, a Christian's life is different to another person's life in really only one way. They want their desires to become what God desires. So when I ask you the question, as a Christian, what do you really need in a community? Hopefully something about that will be the answer that you'd give. I want to become more like God. Because if we want to want less than what God wants, we're wanting less than God, and that runs afoul of the great commandment to love God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength. Doesn't end well. It is very hard to call oneself a Christian, a little Christ, if we do not want to become even a little like the Christ who died for us, offered us forgiveness, and gave us his Spirit so that we might become like him. And it might be like you, like me, want to become like Christ but find it hard. Is that a reasonable comment? You want to be like Christ, but you find it challenging? Me too. Reasonably so, the bigger and more noble the goal, the harder and more challenging the path, right? If you want a goal that's easy to achieve, lower it. But if you want something noble, it's going to be hard. Fortunately, God has sent us his Spirit. But his Spirit does not work on us in a vacuum. The Spirit does something to us that we see in this story. It puts us together so that we might be formed into his likeness. And I don't know if you, I often don't reflect on the 12 disciples much about what their character and nature must have been like. But I did think about it this week. When I thought about the 12 that Jesus, well, that the Father gave to Jesus. Remember, he goes up to the mountain and the Father says, you know, here are the ones you're to select as the 12 close to you. Have you thought of what it might have been like for Simon the Zealot? So think of a committed nationalist who is willing to take up arms to fight the enemy for the sake of Israel. Being in the same group as close friends to Jesus with Matthew the tax collector, who for every Israelite, any tax collector is a traitor working for the Romans. These two should not get on together. They couldn't be more politically opposed to one another. It's like Trump and Biden folk getting together in the same church saying, well, we better get on. I mean, I don't know if that makes any sense to you because I don't really know too much about American politics, but it seems pretty polarized over there. What about James and John, whom Jesus nicknamed the Sons of Thunder? Now, what is that about? Is that because of their temper? I don't know, but I do know for sure that they came up to Jesus sometime along the way and said, hey, by the way, what's it going to take for us to become your right-hand men in the kingdom, you know? How can we get ahead of everyone else? You don't need 12, Jesus. You just need two. Us two. Now, that didn't go down well in the group. We know that much. This is a group of misfits. A group of people who don't naturally belong to one another, who shouldn't get on together, a group of people for whom it probably rained a lot, to use my current running metaphor about golfers and gardeners, but who at the end, and when things got sticky and people were leaving Jesus, Jesus turned to them and said, well, what about you guys? Are you going too? And what did they say? Well, where else can we go? You have the words of life. Which isn't a ringing endorsement for the fact they enjoyed being with Jesus. It was more a, we've got nowhere else to go. Which, frankly, is where you're at right now, because you're either with the church or you're in the wicked generation. You don't really have other alternatives. So if you don't like the church, well, I'm sorry. That's the plan. And if it's a little rainy for you right now, are you a golfer or a gardener? Because how you determine what you're doing here will determine how you respond to it. And that'll be true with your life groups. Whatever group you find yourself in, you will not like some of the people some of the time. I think I can be sure of that. Now, there is a good way you can do this. You can just keep everyone at a distance, at that nice level. But the 12 disciples didn't really have that choice. They rubbed shoulders a lot. They couldn't fake it for very long. I don't think that the 3,000 that gathered together that first day were any different fundamentally either. Lots of people who wouldn't have got along except for the fact that Jesus called them. That was the only thing that kept the 12 together. It's the only thing that kept those 3,000 together. It's probably close to being the only thing that keeps a church going anywhere. If the church is going anywhere. So the Christian answer, dare I suggest it, to the question, what kind of group do you want to be part of? Is this. One that helps me love my enemy. That's the reason you should be coming to church and joining a life group. Learning how to love your enemy. Which is another way of Jesus saying, learn to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to learn to love your neighbor as you love yourself. Because I can guarantee you these other things. You are not going to like your neighbor. There are times that you are your own enemy, and God stands opposed to your prideful plans. Our challenge in life is to learn to love our enemies, and we are surrounded by them. We are beset by them. Our heads ring to the voices of enemy voices. There is no easy escape from this. Which is why we need one another. Firstly, because if the people you are with have the same attitude, the same desire, they want to be... If you could flick to the next slide for me, Jake. Jesus said in Matthew 5, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers and sisters, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? You therefore must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. If you happen to find yourself in a group of people who have the same heart desire as that, knowing we all fall far short of it, and therefore needing one another to help us do it. And then we'll start with each other. We'll start in the group that we're in, recognizing that at times someone else's need might run afoul of my want. I don't know if you discovered this, if you, any one of you are married, that sometimes in married life, someone else's need in that marriage means that you don't get what you want. And you have to learn to live at peace. And vice versa. I don't know if you found, if you had children, that you prayed to the Lord the kind of children that you might have, and he gave you the ones that you do have. And they don't always match up with your expectations. That's what happened, says my father. You find yourself surrounded even by people whom you love with people who frustrate you, who contend with you for what should be done or could be done or will be done. And it's a constant, perhaps not constant, but it's a regular rubbing and discussion and back and forth and a learning to break bread in conflict. At least though at home, you hope you have the solidarity of, well, I made a covenant with you and I'm not going to break that. Now peace can find a way. And hopefully if you make these life groups, you have the same attitude. I'm not very good at loving my enemy. And I say that as a personal statement. I need others to help me. It helps to have people in my life who have the same attitude so that in covenant we can go head to head, bang, 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 cause it to rain, and then still say, you know what, but we love one another. And the fact that I didn't agree with you on that point hasn't changed that. And the fact that I'm having to agree to disagree with you is improving me. I'm becoming better for it. So I want to finish with something that my mother shared with me a few years ago. It's called Bless My Enemies, O Lord. And it's written by a guy called Nikolai Velimirovich. Don't ask me to say that again. Serbian bishop in the last century. Now, he challenged the Nazis and was ultimately arrested and taken to the concentration camp Dachau. And he writes this: Bless my enemies, O Lord. Even I bless them and do not curse them. Enemies have driven me into your embrace more than friends have. Friends have bound me to earth. Enemies have loosed me from earth and have demolished all my aspirations in the world. Enemies have made me a stranger in worldly realms and an extraneous inhabitant of the world. Just as a hunted animal finds safer shelter than an unhunted animal does, so have I, persecuted by enemies, found the safest sanctuary, having ensconced myself beneath your tabernacle, where neither friends nor enemies can slay my soul. Bless my enemies, O Lord, even I bless them and do not curse them. They, rather than I, have confessed my sins before the world. They have punished me whenever I have hesitated to punish myself. They have tormented me whenever I have tried to flee torment. They have scolded me when I have flattered myself. They have spat upon me whenever I have filled myself with arrogance. Bless my enemies, O Lord. Even I bless them and do not curse them. Whenever I have made myself wise, they called me foolish. Whenever I have made myself mighty, they have mocked me as though I were a dwarf. Whenever I have wanted to lead people, they have shoved me into the background. Whenever I have rushed to enrich myself, they have prevented me with an iron hand. Whenever I thought that I would sleep peacefully, they have wakened me from sleep. Whenever I have tried to build a home for a long and tranquil life, they have demolished it and driven me out. Truly, enemies have cut me loose from the world and have stretched out my hands to the hem of your garment. Bless my enemies, O Lord. Even I bless them and do not curse them. Bless them and multiply them. Multiply them and make them even more bitterly against me, so that my fleeing to you may have no return, so that all hope in men may be scattered like cobwebs, so that absolute serenity may begin to reign in my soul, so that my heart may become the grave of two evil twins, arrogance and anger. Remember, this is a man who spoke out against the Nazis, now reflecting on what he was like even then. so that I might amass all my treasure in heaven. Ah, so that I may for once be freed from self-deception, which has entangled me in the dreadful web of illusory life. Enemies have taught me to know what hardly anyone knows, that a person has no enemies in this world except himself. Take that on board. One hates his enemies only when he fails to realize that they are not enemies, but cruel friends. It is truly difficult for me to say who has done me more good and who has done me more evil in the world, friends or enemies. Therefore, bless, O Lord, both my friends and enemies. A slave curses enemies for he does not understand, but a son blesses them for he understands. For a son knows that his enemies cannot touch his life. Therefore, he freely steps among them and prays to God for them. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. Are we children of God, gardeners, who when it rains celebrate, when chaos falls in a community you say, good, now we're being honest at last? Because that's normally what happens when chaos bursts out. You're seeing honesty, you're seeing the masks come down, and you are being yourself as they are being their selves. Thank you, Lord, for the chaos. Thank you for the rain, because at last something lasting can grow. What kind of group do you want to be part of? What kind of church do you want to be? I'm just going to let that marinate. Mai ho a koe manaaki, mana koe tiaki. Mai ho e mea ki a ti aho tōna mata ki a koe. Mana hoki koe a te whai. Mai ho a tōna ka nohi a whakaara ki a koe. Mana anō a tuku te rangamarie ki a koe. Yahweh will show you kindness, he will protect you. Yahweh will cause to shine his face on you, he will also show you kindness. Yahweh will lift his eyes up towards you and grant you peace. Amen.